Well, today on the Kenai Conversation, we're talking about opioid drugs and Narcan, which is, it's another drug, but it's like a miracle drug, really. It will save somebody's life if they are experiencing an opioid overdose, like heroin or OxyContin or all these other things that folks are taking. And I've got in the studio today a couple of folks to talk about this. We've heard about it before on the radio, on the news. Fred Koski, who is the Addictions Program Coordinator at Peninsula Community Health Services of Alaska. Good morning.
Morning.
Yeah, and also Shara Pritchard, who is a public health nurse with the State of Alaska at the Kenai Public Health Center. How are you this morning?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Thanks to you guys for coming in. Well, you know, I first got word of this, you know, I think I spoke with you, Frank, about, Fred, rather, about the monthly, what would you call them, seminar sessions?
We're calling them a community education series.
Okay. And tell us what you're doing at these things.
So mostly it's just a quick presentation about kind of the science of opioids and addiction, and then a quick presentation from the public health nurses about Narcan. And then at the end of the presentation, anybody that wants to receive a Narcan kit can get one from the public Division of Public Health Nursing to carry on hand, to have kind of with them when they are out in the world, so that if they do see a situation where someone's having an opioid overdose, they can save that life.
And I described it briefly as a kind of a miracle drug. Is it really? I mean, I have heard amazing stories of recovery from this. And does it work just like that?
It does, Kara? Work just like that. It is a very quick acting and very safe medication for opioid overdose. So it actually pops opioids off the receptors that drive breathing, and so it allows a person to just start breathing again, as long as they're not too far gone.
Right, because opioids are nervous system suppressants, right? And it'll slow, people die because they just stop, they slow down and stop breathing, right?
Yeah. Opioids, they act on the nervous system to relieve pain, so they do their job really well, which is why they're prescribed. And then continued use and abuse of those medications can lead to that physical dependence, where people will have withdrawal symptoms if they stop. And basically, too much of an opioid affects the parts of the brain that drive breathing, and as a result, their breathing can become slowed, stopped, or their heart rate can become slowed or stopped. And basically, overdoses whenever you had too much of a good thing.
Oh, man. You know, I will admit to you to having taken opioids. It was codeine back in the day, and Valium for 3 months after I broke my back. And it was amazing. Everybody's all, oh, you got codeine, man, you know, because I'm a teenager. And I was like, no, it's not like that, man. I don't get high at all from it, you know, but I'm not in pain. And I thought that was just me, but I found out when somebody is in pain, opioids don't get them high, do they? It just makes them feel less pain, right?
Yeah, it all depends on kind of the dose that you're taking. Particularly, yeah, it like Shara said, it's a very effective pain medication. However, you know, it's for the temporary relief of pain. Long term, it's interesting that there have been more and more studies showing that ibuprofen and some limited physical activity is actually more effective than opioids for dealing with folks who have chronic pain. So acute pain, post-surgical pain, that kind of initial 3 or 4 days where you're really hurting, opioids can be really effective. But it's that long term use of opioids that kind of created the problem that we're all working on dealing with right now.
Mm-hmm. I remember 20 years ago or so, I was at the Clarion, and we had started doing a bunch of stories. I think it turned out to be a series by Doug Loshbaugh. But they were about OxyContin, the rise of OxyContin. It was about 20-some years ago. And they've been in the news again lately. The company that makes that is now in trouble for encouraging the overprescription of these things.
Yeah, I think it's Purdue Pharmaceuticals,
right,
if I'm correct. Yeah, there's multiple lawsuits, I think, in several states in regards to how they marketed the drug to particularly healthcare providers. One of the early marketing campaigns that Purdue and a lot of the other pharmaceutical companies that deal with particularly these extended-release opioids like OxyContin were pushing the fact that it was non-addictive, and I'm putting air quotes around that because that's really what they were telling docs and people that were in a position to prescribe these medications, that it was non-addictive, non-habit forming. And that's kind of the, I think, why they're being, why the lawsuits are being generated.
Right. I remember those claims, them claiming that, well, it's so time released that there's no way they could get high on this. Well, they didn't think of people opening the capsules and grinding it up, I suppose.
Yeah, and also it's interesting the way that the physical dependence of opioids, and it's not just opioids that cause physical dependence. A lot of medications can do that, but for instance, I'm physically dependent on caffeine myself. So the fact that I don't have coffee in front of me is a little bit nerve-wracking. But
I've got an unopened Rockstar.
I think I'm doing all right. I think I'll manage for the next hour. But it's that physical dependence that that creates this kind of vicious cycle where you need more of the medication to get the same effect that you had initially, and then as you kind of plateau at that level, and then you're looking for that effect again, and it's regardless of it's true that in regards to getting high, but also with just the ability to mask or deal with pain, you get less and less of an effect over time, so you have to escalate the dose, and that's what kind of leads to that physical dependence portion that's so dangerous with particularly with the opioids.
Wow. I see you have copies of your PowerPoint presentation. Could you maybe walk us through how you do that? Because you just had one of these meetings here last week, right?
Yeah. So the idea with the presentation is to kind of educate the public a little bit about the opioid issue. Working in substance use treatment, there's a lot of really interesting and new information, particularly around the fact that addiction is a chronic disease of the brain, and kind of how that's informing treatment and some of the new thinking and modalities around that. But what we haven't done a great job of is kind of getting that information out to the public. And we thought this was a nice opportunity to kind of open the door to the community to kind of get that information. We know there's a lot of people that are interested in this topic. They want to learn more. And we kind of were looking at what are the questions that we deal with a lot from folks that are wanting to learn more about this. So the PowerPoint, kind of the goals of the PowerPoint are to understand the basic science of opioids from a lay perspective, rather than trying to put it into a whole bunch of scientific jargon, understand why people abuse opioids, understand the difference between dependence and addiction, because we find that that's something that a lot of people struggle with, trying to figure out the difference between those two things. We partner with the Division of Public Health Nursing because we like working with those folks. And so we thought it'd be also a nice opportunity to distribute some Narcan kits out to the public. So in that case, also recognizing an opioid overdose, how to safely administer Narcan, and then what to do after the Narcan's administered, because it's not just a matter of hitting them with the Narcan and letting them go on their way.
I understand quite often people who are brought back with Narcan are not happy. Like, they're very upset. Like,
yes. You might expect a person to be very agitated, maybe even combative. Basically, we're putting them into straight withdrawal, and withdrawal for many people is extremely painful. So.
Oh.
Yeah, so the interesting thing is, of course, the person that's experiencing the overdose doesn't know that they're overdosing. They're not cognitively aware enough to know that that's what's happening to them. So all they know is that they were feeling really, really good, and they weren't really aware of a whole lot, and then suddenly they're feeling really, really bad. And in the case of something where somebody's overdosed on an illicit substance like heroin, or has intentionally abused their prescribed opioid medication, you're looking at a situation where, depending on what they paid for that, they feel like you just wasted their money, and wasted their high if that was their intent. The other thing we like to highlight with this presentation, particularly around Narcan, is that Narcan prevents any kind of accidental overdose, though, whether it's illicit use or whether it's just, a child getting into your, the codeine that you got from the dentist after you had your wisdom teeth pulled, or whether it's, an elderly patient that maybe forgot that they took their medication already that day, and then they take a little bit extra. And in the case of where I work at PCHS, we had a patient recently who went out to shovel snow. And hurt his back a little bit, and he was prescribed an opioid medication for his chronic pain, and he decided, well, I'm going to take a couple extra because my back hurts a little bit more today, and then he ended up passing out from just that couple extra. And so it's really not just around a lot of the conversation around Narcan does tend to be around that illicit overdose kind of, people misusing their medications or using heroin. But really the idea behind the Narcan is that anybody's susceptible, to experiencing these kind of overdoses, to the point where I think nationally, and I think in the state now, accidental opioid overdose has overtaken car accidents as the number one cause of accidental death.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Holy cow. So it is important to point out that it's not just, heroin addicts scuttling around behind the hockey rink. It's you can find these drugs in your grandma's medicine cabinet, and you need to be careful.
Yeah, I think that's the big thing we want to make sure people understand is that the Narcan's not just targeted towards folks who are misusing the medications or misusing heroin or using heroin, I should say. But it's also to kind of help anybody because there's so many of these medications out there, and a lot of people tend to store the medication, right? They don't use all of their prescription after their surgery, but they kind of put it in the medicine cabinet for a rainy day in case something else happens, you're shoveling snow and tweak your back. So these medications are kind of sitting out there, and it doesn't really take a whole lot, particularly if your tolerance is really low, to put you in a place where you've taken too much.
Yeah. And just from a public health standpoint, we continue to educate people whenever we do give them Narcan kits at our health center, is that they also need to understand that by using them safely, they're protecting themselves, but by safely storing their medications, they're protecting others, and they're actually stopping that diversion of medications, and then safely disposing those medications that they're not utilizing, rather than saving them, taking them to the drug take-back days that occur in April and October every year here, and making sure to get them off the shelves. They're no longer useful, and that way people aren't taking them out of their medicine cabinets.
Right.
Yeah, and also I think at Public Health, at PCHS, and some of the pharmacies in the area as well, you can get a drug disposal bag, which is a safe, environmentally friendly way of disposing of these medications. And it's any medication. It doesn't have to be opioids, but it renders the medication inert. And then you can toss it in the garbage rather than flushing them down the toilet and contaminating the water supply.
Wait, what's in the bag that makes them inert?
It's a charcoal-based system. It allows it to be deactivated. And then, obviously, once it's deactivated, people are not going to be able to eat the charcoal or anything like that because that would cause them to vomit. So.
Right. Let me give out our phone number, 283-8414, if you'd like to call in and talk about opioids and Narcan, and if you have experience with either, honestly, if you have experience with Narcan, I would love to hear from you. Our phone number, 283-8414, give us a call and we'll put you on the air. We're talking with Fred Koski of PCHS and Shara Pritchard, public health nurse at the Kenai Public Health Center. You mentioned the drug take-back days, turn-in days?
Yes.
Yeah, when I first heard of those, I thought maybe it was an exchange, and I'd go in and... just a bad drug joke, sorry. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I've used narcotics since 1991 or 92. They had me on patches and, oh my man. So... I had some pretty horrific accidents. Fell down 12 stairs. I got hit by a boat, got hit by a drunk driver. So I've got a list. Now, I've found that pure nutrition, real nutrition, like things like aminos, a complete amino, complete mineral, a good one a day, a real food one a day, my pain isn't so great, and I've been able to cut my meds down to a third.
Oh, wow. So how long did that take? How long did that happen for that change to happen?
Within about a month, I woke up realizing I don't have to take a tablet today.
That's terrific to hear. Do you have any questions or for our guests here?
No. This was just for their, this is like, it worked. It truly worked. I had no withdrawal. I wasn't trying to reduce. It just went away. My body needed support. And I just wanted to bring that to their attention. And thanks for having me on.
You bet. Thanks for calling. And I can't wait to see your book on how to beat opioid drugs.
I got it from about a million books. I wouldn't be able to, with my head injury from the drunk driver, I would not be able to put it all together. But it works.
Well, thanks for sharing it with us.
Okay, have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye. Do you guys find that, you know, proper diet and vitamins and such is a good plan for people to maybe reduce their amount of drug intake? Is that something you can comment on? Or?
I would just always say that living with a healthy idea in mind for every individual in any scenario would be a great idea. You know, we work at public health. We're really focused on the science and practice of preventing disease, promoting health, and prolonging life for the population as a whole. So I would say that's great.
Okay.
True. Yeah, and from my perspective, you know, I think what it highlights is that there's a lot of different options for folks in regards to treating their pain, but for so long we've been dependent on just writing a prescription for opioids and then sending people on their way. And it can be, they're very effective, and so it's an easy fix. But, you know, physical therapy, other interventional pain modalities, you know, and just getting a little bit of physical activity and exercise, diet and nutrition is very important in regards to just kind of overall maintaining a healthy lifestyle. So, yeah, there's a lot of options to treat both acute pain and chronic pain. But for so long, I think it's just been opioids for so long that I think it's hard to get, you know, we're transitioning people off now, which is what the CDC is recommending in regards to getting people off of opioids and then not prescribing opioids as heavily. But we're in that transitional phase right now. And for some folks who've been dependent on these medications to kind of live their lives for so long, it's a very scary prospect to kind of suddenly be taken off of them. And so, you know, we try to highlight the fact that there's a lot of other options for them. They might not work as quickly, might require a little bit more effort, but they're definitely as effective, if not more effective than opioid medication. Because the truth is, for treating chronic pain, opioids aren't really that effective.
Really?
They're great for acute pain, but because of that dose escalation effect and that tolerance effect that you get, they're not really great for treating chronic pain.
Oh, okay. You mentioned a couple of times treatment modalities, and I think you were just touching on them. Can you go through what some of the other of them are treatment modalities?
Yeah, I mean, so not being a physician myself, I should clarify that, but working around and with physicians for a long time, there's a lot of different things that can be done. There's you know, physical therapy and kind of correcting muscular imbalances and kind of working through some of your functional strength and kind of those things can definitely help in regards to working through pain. There are interventional things like injections, you know, facet injections and other things that interventional pain specialists can help with. There are surgical options for people where that really is an appropriate, you know, option for surgical pain. You know, there's a lot of different things that docs can kind of provide for you as far as, and obviously your situation is going to be dependent on what's going on with you. But it's important to kind of talk with your docs about what are the options other than just opioid pain medications, and kind of be open to the idea of maybe exploring some of those things. And what's interesting is that, particularly with acute pain, they're finding that ibuprofen and then not taking it easy, but actually being active within your ability to tolerate that is actually better to prevent chronic pain once you've had an acute injury than almost anything else.
Yeah. You know, they did not have that information when I was young and hurting myself left and right, and I'm going to be paying for it here in my old day, in my dotage. So do you find there's any resistance to trying different modalities, you know, these different different techniques that you're talking about? And because opioids are so easy to get, I mean, do you find that to be the path of least resistance among abusers?
Not just among abusers. I think because it's been such a readily available option for folks, and because it was for a long time the first line option in a lot of cases, it is difficult sometimes, even with people who are, you know, getting new injuries. It is kind of a challenge because it requires effort, right? The opioid doesn't require much effort. You take the medication, it takes your pain away. You can go back to work. You can live your life. You can take care of your kids. You can do the dishes and all of that. Whereas things like physical therapy and these other treatment modalities do take some time to work and develop, but it's really the idea of getting to the underlying cause of the problem rather than a quick fix solution. And that's where opiates can help still in regards to kind of that acute pain phase or post-surgical pain. But yeah, there is some resistance to it because everyone wants the thing that works the quickest to get them back to where they were functional.
Sure. What are some of the drugs that Narcan can work on? I mean, you mentioned codeine and OxyContin, but there's a whole family of these opiates.
Yeah, yes. So Narcan is effective against opioids such as heroin, methadone, OxyContin, Vicodin, Percocet, codeine, fentanyl, Dilaudid, morphine, all of the opioid drugs. It is effective against.
Well, so Michael Jackson could still be alive and Prince could still be alive if they had some Narcan.
If somebody was there and saw them overdosing and they were a bystander that was trained to give Narcan, they absolutely could have done that.
Tell me about the training. What does that involve?
So the training just talks about what an opioid is, what causes the overdose, specifically how Narcan works. And how Narcan works basically is it bonds more strongly to the opioid receptors than the opioid drugs. So it knocks the opioids off the receptors for a very short time, and this blocks the effect of that overdose, allowing the person to breathe again.
Where are these receptors at? Are they in the brain?
They're in the brain, oh, okay. Yes. There are pain receptors, and that's what tells us that we have pain. And how opioids work is they bond to those and say, oh, you don't have pain. Well, then Narcan actually comes in if you're overdosing, if somebody has administered it to you and knocks those opioids off those receptors. But the important thing to know about Narcan is that it usually only works for 30 to 45 minutes. So it's not replacing professional medical attention whatsoever. All it's doing is allowing someone to start breathing again, and then the bystander should always call 911.
Oh, because in a half an hour they may relapse?
They may go back right into overdose again, yes.
Oh, no kidding.
Yes, yes. And so the nice thing about calling 911 is that the ambulance is probably going to be bringing more Narcan as well, because they probably have it stocked in the ambulance. I'm fairly certain of that. And then if for any chance that this individual had something else going on, then EMS can address that.
So. Mm-hmm. And then how is it administered? You know, say an innocent bystander gets some training, they have a packet in their coat and they see somebody overdosing, what do they do?
Yep. So there's many formulations or I guess many ways to give Narcan, but the ones that we have gotten or received through Project Hope, the entity that has the funds to purchase these kits, are nasal. They're nasal kits. So basically what you do is you see somebody overdosing. If their face is clammy to the touch, they've lost their color, they've got trouble speaking, or they have pinpoint pupils. If their body is limp, they're not responding to you, to voice, touch, or any commands. If they're in a deep sleep and can't be woken and their breathing is slowing or stopped, you put the nasal applicator in their nose and you press firmly on the plunger and it sprays the medication into their nose.
And presumably it only helps if they still have a heartbeat, right?
Well, and basically, here's the thing, is this is like in addition to your CPR and your first aid training, right?
Oh,
so
okay.
You're going to use this as a supplemental tool to help you take care of another person. But the only thing that Narcan does, the only thing that it does is affect opioids. So if opioids are not present in the body, it is not going to do anything. So like for the case that a kid maybe got a hold of this Narcan and they sprayed it in their nose, it's not going to harm them. It's only going to affect the opioids.
That was my very next question. The safety of the Narcan
itself. So it's just fine. It's not like an epinephrine pen. It's not like that where you're going to get.
Yeah, no. The only thing that it will do, especially if somebody is dependent on opioids, is it's going to put them in withdrawal. So basic withdrawal symptoms for people can be vomiting, agitation, restlessness, diarrhea, and so that can be extremely painful. So those, for someone that doesn't have opioids or doesn't have an opioid addiction, it may not harm them, but when somebody is dependent, they're going to feel those side effects, so that is going to be uncomfortable for them.
Yeah. Sure. But it's important to keep in mind that they're breathing. So, yeah.
We have another phone call here. Let's go to the phones. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, it's me again. Okay, with all my time of being on this narcotic, they almost had to give me Narcan one time in the hospital because my liver wasn't processing it, and I was pretty sick, not even from an accidental overdose. My liver just wasn't getting rid of it, and it backed up on me. And when they found out I'd been on it for so long, someone said, "You can't do it. She'll go into seizures."
Oh, wow.
So I thought I'd bring that out because of the long-term use. It had been like maybe 15 years at that time. So, I just thought I'd point that out because I just overheard it. He was in the hall. You can't do it.
Oh, great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, and the idea behind the Narcan, keep in mind, is, you know, in a hospital setting, they're going to make different decisions, you know, when you've got physicians and nurses on staff right there ready to take care of you. But with the Narcan, especially out in public, what we're looking at is this is a life-saving measure, right? It's no different than CPR. So the idea is that if you don't administer the Narcan, there's a very good chance that person dies. So the idea is administer that Narcan, get EMS on the way, and any other potential negative side effects that could come from the fact that they're in withdrawal, or in the case of this situation, if you're out in public and there was a seizure, 911, EMS, they can deal with those other situations because that person's still alive. So yeah, that is a good point. But the idea behind the Narcan is that this is for folks that are out in public seeing somebody that could potentially be experiencing an opioid overdose. I also like that the caller brought up. We call these drugs a lot of different things. Opioid tends to be what we're leaning on right now, but narcotics, anything that you've heard called a narcotic, is also an opioid type medication. Sometimes you'll hear it referred to as opiates. I like that she mentioned narcotics because that's something that also has come up in the trainings that we've done. And then for us as well, what I try to tell people when I do the Narcan training that for the kits that we dispense at PCHS is that if you're not sure, if you've got somebody that's non-responsive, they don't look like they're doing okay, and you're not sure what happened, right? Because it's not always obvious that they're having an opiate overdose, right? Administer that Narcan and then start those CPR protocols that, you know, if you've had first aid training, start all those processes. The most important step is getting 911 on the way, but it doesn't hurt to administer that Narcan because it's not going to create negative side effects. It's not a stimulant, which I think a lot of people do think that's the mechanism of action. And like Shara said, I always try to explain it as it's like an electrical outlet, right? And what Narcan does is it comes along and unplugs the electrical outlet. It takes that opiate out of the outlet and then puts one of those little protective covers on there so that the opiate can't bind back to the receptor.
Yeah, you know, I was one of those ones who thought it was some sort of super stimulant, you know, like an EpiPen.
Yeah, it's really interesting that it's almost like it was. I think I heard one of the public health nurses during the training call it basically a miracle drug because there's very few medications that are out there that don't cause some sort of side effect when they're being a potential side effect. But naloxone or Narcan truly seems to be one of those medications that really doesn't come with a lot of negative side effects. And then the other thing we like to point out, because we're in Alaska and a lot of people have pets, Narcan's effective on if an animal were to get into someone's opiate medication. It'll work the same way with your dog or your cat. So if Fido accidentally gets into your oxycodone from the dentist, the Narcan will work to reverse that as well.
Wow. You mentioned methadone earlier. And that's a drug that started out for heroin addicts to take them off of it, and then it became a drug that's abused, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm glad Narcan doesn't have any of that. Our phone number is 283-8414. We are going to take a couple of minute break here.
see if we can dig up some coffee for our guests. And we'll be back in just a minute. You're listening to the Kenai Conversation. We're talking about opioids and Narcan.
Thank you.
listening to the Kenai Conversation here on Public Radio KDLL. I'm Jay Barrett. I have in the studio with me today Fred Koski, who is the Addiction Programs Coordinator at PCHS, and Shara Pritchard, a public health nurse with the state of Alaska. Shara, I couldn't help but notice before we were on the air, you said something about your former teachers. So you grew up here. You're from here. Oh, wait, I don't have your mic on. I'm sorry.
Ooh, sorry. Yes, I'm from here. I grew up here.
So. Wow. And so you came back and you're a public health nurse.
Absolutely. Love to be able to serve my community.
Right. That's terrific. Man. Afraid you got anything to match that?
No. Negative. Nope. Okay. I got nothing to match that.
That's okay. Shara seems pretty on the ball here. During the break, we were talking about some of the other things that about the opioids and education and tools here. That I think we should. I thought I saw the phone blink, but it was a different one. Let me give the number 283-8414 if you'd like to talk with us about opioids and Narcan, a community education series. You folks had an event last week, and the next one is March 28th, 5:30 to 6:00 at the PCHS office on Marydale.
Yeah, and we'll be repeating them the last Thursday of every month.
Okay. How long has this been going on? I don't remember from when I interviewed you about for a story about this.
So we started in January. So the February was the second one. This upcoming one in March will be the third one.
Okay. Are you getting many folks coming by? And what are they asking? You mentioned dependence versus addiction was one of the main things there.
Yeah, the first turnout, I think we had 15 people show up. This most recent turnout, we had about three. So it's kind of escalating and de-escalating numbers. Part of that was I didn't get flyers out quite as quickly as I had intended. So that's part of that's in my to-do list for this week is to get flyers out. But the dependence versus addiction, I think that's one that a lot of people struggle with. It's one of the questions I just get asked a lot. Once folks realize that I work with the substance use population and substance use treatment, a lot of people it's a struggle because it's a really fine line in some cases. But really, the difference is dependence. Really, it comes down to tolerance plus withdrawal, right? It's that escalating dosage effect, and then if you stop taking the medication, you have withdrawal from it. Well, that would mean that you're physically dependent on the medication, whereas addiction is there's a lot of different definitions of it. We chose the NIDA definition because it's the shortest one, but it's a chronic relapsing brain disease. It's characterized by compulsive drug seeking and use despite harmful consequences. So the big difference really is that dependence is mostly a physical process. People who are dependent on medications are still able to kind of meet social obligations, work obligations, family obligations. They can control their use. Typically, folks who are dependent don't have really strong cravings for the medication they're dependent on. They're not obsessing about the medication. You know, it's not something that is constantly on their mind. Whereas with addiction, it's a really complex process. It's both physiological and psychological. There's a lot of compulsive use, even if the person doesn't want to use. What's interesting is when I deal with our clients and the people that we work with, a lot of times they don't actually want to go out and use again. They want to stop using, but it's that compulsive need that kind of drives them to that, because the way that these that addiction affects the brain just decreases that willpower component. It's a pretty interesting process. And then they struggle to meet their obligations, both with work and family. And that use of the substance becomes the primary drive to function during the day. It becomes their obsession. It becomes a compulsion for them to use. And so really we like to talk about the fact that you can be dependent on a lot of different medications. There's antidepressants that people can become dependent on, but no one develops a criminal lifestyle around Zoloft. Right. Clonidine is a blood pressure medication that if you take it for long term, you can become dependent on it and you'll have physical symptoms if you stop taking it, but you don't really crave that medication. Right. Or insulin, diabetics who use insulin are dependent on that insulin to regulate their blood sugar, but they don't ruin their relationships just to get more.
So is that a function of the opioids acting on the pleasure and reward center of the brain as well as the pain receptors?
Yeah, really all addiction hijacks that reward reward center. You know, your brain releases dopamine in regard when it accomplishes particularly a survival based task, right? Food, intercourse, like those kind of things will release dopamine in the brain, and the things that people become addicted to have a similar function. And what happens over time is the brain learns that if you do this thing, you get this really nice dopamine response. And then it's like Pavlov's dogs, right? Where after a while that response becomes conditioned to where it starts to overtake everything else. And then there's a lot of other scientific stuff that happens in regards to receptor downregulation and a lot of other things. But really what it comes down to is it hijacks that reward mechanism, and it turns the use of that substance or the engaging in that behavior into something that's as critical to survival as eating or drinking.
Wow. So, and that's, the addict feels that. They feel that they need to take this drug just as much as they need to eat and breathe and drink water.
Yeah. Yeah. And in some cases, even more so.
Wow.
Yeah.
Shoot, I had a great question. Oh, willpower. I wrote it down, actually. You're talking about willpower. It's not a somebody who is addicted does not necessarily lack willpower, right? I mean, it is in their brain as real as the color blue, right? That they must have this or they will die.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even if it's not true. I mean, that's in their brain.
Yeah, absolutely. It becomes a, you know, a lot of times I think what happens is particularly in kind of an old school way of thinking about addiction, it's been about a moral failing or people can just stop. But really, it's like asking somebody to stop breathing. It is a difficult process because of the way that these things affect the brain. They hijack that reward circuit and they kind of take circuitry that is intended for your survival and kind of hacks it, to put it in kind of modern lingo, it kind of hacks it so that it turns this substance or this behavior into the thing that actually becomes more critical to survival than those other things.
You know, when you're talking about how these things affect somebody, you know, who's addicted, you know, and they go on and they must have it and it affects their jobs. And of course that can create a criminal out of somebody, and politics, being what they are, don't necessarily see addiction as anything more than a lack of willpower. I find quite often, and that the politics of drug policy is tied up in the politics of, well, why can't they just fix themselves?
Yeah, and you know, being a representative of PCHS, I don't want to get too much into personal politics, but yeah. And what's interesting though is that there's a lot of shift in thinking around providing treatment behind the walls, and you know, and when people are incarcerated and they've kind of suffered the consequences of you know, this particular lifestyle, that there is more of a focus on trying to get folks treatment while they're incarcerated, while they don't have access to these substances, so that as they transition back to the outside world, they have better tools to kind of cope. Because really, most of the time, people don't become addicted to a substance because they've got really great things happening for them. Usually it's a way to escape something negative, right? Whether it's childhood trauma or whether it's, you know, homelessness, joblessness, there's a lot of reasons people kind of fall to these things. And so the idea is that as we transition, you know, there's a lot of reentry coalitions and a lot of focus on reentry and kind of helping people reintegrate back into society as part of their incarceration. And I think that there is an interesting shift nationally towards that model. And there's, you know, there's been some work in Alaska kind of moving forward to that. And I hope that, you know, the new administration taking over kind of prioritizes a lot of these things, but I think it impacts a lot more members of our community than people even realize.
Do you have any idea how many?
No.
Well, I just have an addition to that, is that he talked about some determinants that maybe make an individual more or higher risk for substance abuse or misuse. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that individual won't become addicted, even if they have those kind of social determinants, which might make them more likely to. I think it's important to know that opioids are very powerful and they've kind of seeded their way into every social class in our communities, in our country, and I don't really think that anybody is immune to being able to develop an addiction to opioids. So,
Yeah, I always use the analogy of like a baseball game, that some folks start in the batter's box. Some folks start, depending on your risk factors, on first base. Some folks start on second base, depending on the level of risk factors that you have. Eventually, everyone gets around to home plate. It's just a matter of, you know, where you start on, as you're running the bases.
Sure, unless you're caught stealing on the... No, I... Thank you for making a baseball reference.
Yeah, no worries.
You had some more numbers, I think, Cher. We were talking about some of these figures.
Yeah, I just have a couple facts about the opioid epidemic and the misuse of opioids in Alaska. So I'll give you three.
Okay.
Number one here, drug overdose was actually Alaska's leading cause of accidental death for 2016, which Fred mentioned earlier. And then more than three out of five drug overdoses actually involved an opioid. And that was through the CDC and from our Department of Health and Social Services. And then also 7% of Alaska youth have misused a prescription pain medication in the past 30 days. And that actually came from our Alaska Youth Risk Behavior Survey.
So only three out of five are drug. What on earth are the other two drugs that could kill you that are, if they're not opioids? Doesn't say on your list.
It
there.
Does not say no. Uh-uh.
Yeah, the thing that I like to highlight too is that it wouldn't surprise me if alcohol was included in some of those numbers, just because alcohol remains the number one substance use problem in the state of Alaska, and something that we try not to lose focus on as we're kind of as all these resources are being put behind the opioid epidemic, and then there's also a pretty big methamphetamine issue, in the state and in the area.
And sometimes it's not one or the other. It's poly substance abuse is what we call it, is that when you're using multiple substance at any given time.
Mm-hmm. Wow. We had also talked about Project Hope, which I guess is a state of Alaska program. And optimistically, it sounds like it might not get zeroed out this year because they forward funded it, right?
What's the program? Yeah, so... In October of 2016, actually, the Department of Health and Social Services received a $4 million grant, and it's supposed to be awarded basically over the next 5 years, or 5 years from 2016, and that was from the SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. And what that was for is to educate, train, and equip first responders and general public on the prevention of opioid overdose-related deaths. There was actually a Senate bill in 2013, it was Senate Bill 23, that was actually passed to help reduce those barriers of us getting Narcan out into the community. So it basically protected people from civil damages resulting from being able to administer the Narcan. So,
right, just like the protections for CPR, people doing CPR.
CPR, it's like
public.
A good Samaritan kind of law. So the nice thing about Project Hope is that they are able to deputize others to be able to give those Narcan kits. So they are the entity that gets the Narcan kits, and then they give them to others. So Governor Walker in 2017 declared a public health disaster emergency due to the magnitude and severity of opioid epidemic in Alaska, and that actually allowed public health to be one of those deputized partners to be able to give out the Narcan, to do the trainings and give it out. So.
Oh, I see. And I understand this is just phase one of this program from Project Hope, right? Or that you guys are doing?
Yeah, well, it was kind of phase one of the state of Alaska's response to the opioid epidemic. The first step, as they saw it, was let's stop people from dying. Let's stop the epidemic and the rate at which people are overdosing and dying from this. And then phase two is the state opioid response, which they really did some work through OSMAP, which is the Office of Substance Misuse and...
Addiction prevention.
Addiction prevention. Thank you. To go to the communities, Alaska is a very unique place because of the geographic size and the diversity of the communities that are here. And so they really wanted to hear from the communities individually on what they wanted, what they felt each community would need in order to kind of address this opioid issue and the substance use issue overall, and then to develop a statewide action plan. And so I think the state has published the action plan I think on the DHSS website.
Yeah, I believe so. And There's a couple other focus points is that they're trying to do right now is obviously prevent dependence on opioids, reduce addiction by recognizing it and treating it appropriately, and then with the Narcan, obviously reversing the life-threatening effects of overdose. And my thought process as a public health nurse is that, you know, Narcan's just a tool to save somebody's life. It's not going to prevent someone from substance misuse. It's not going to prevent them from becoming addicted. The only thing it does is stop imminent death, right? So I think by going on a radio show, partnering with PCHS, and having that collective impact that we can kind of move farther upstream to address, you know, how do we prevent this from even stop or starting in the beginning?
Mm-hmm. Narcan's not a cure. It's just an acute
it's just
tool.
A tool, yep.
There is a guy in Australia, though. I did some research, actually, for this show. And he is treating long-term addicts with long-term usage of microdoses of this and having some success.
Yeah, so there's actually some interesting research in regards to naloxone, which is the generic name of the medication that that is Narcan, around kind of these smaller doses in how it affects the reward system within the brain. And, you know, it's worldwide, there's an issue with substance use and an epidemic with substance use. And there's a lot of interesting research being done in how we kind of approach rehack the reward mechanism so that that people aren't getting that reward from these medications. So yeah, I've heard about the research around naloxone. Actually, the doc I work for kind of mentioned that to me. And there's some other interesting developments in regards to methamphetamine addiction and with medications like gabapentin, which is a nerve pain medication, but also seems to have some effect on helping people reduce their use of methamphetamine and Wellbutrin, which is an antidepressant, as well as some other things. So yeah, there's some really interesting studies going on in regards to using some of these medications in other ways, but we look forward to kind of hearing what they and seeing the results of those studies.
Mm-hmm. This program that, you know, the monthly meetings and such, is this a program you folks developed, or is this a program you borrowed from another community health system around the state? Or
So most of the information is just available through the education that I get as part of my job and the things I've learned. I did borrow very heavily, I think, from a presentation that Dr. Fairbanks gave through the state of Alaska, and I wish I could remember his name, but I can't remember it, but it's from a presentation he gave. So I borrowed pretty heavily because I liked a lot of the way that he presented that information, and then some of it was just based on the questions I get, you know, when I'm out in the community, friends and family even that, you know, that find out that this is what I do. They have a lot of questions. Everyone's got questions about this topic right now because it's so in the forefront of everybody's minds. And so kind of trying to address those questions from just the people that I interact with, and then questions that we get when we're out in the community doing outreach and kind of talking about our program. So the idea was to kind of create a system where people create a little bit of a community education where people could have some of those questions answered in kind of a safe environment where they feel like they're being engaged rather than, you know, just being talked at.
Mm-hmm. Is how would people, you know, say somebody's interested in, well, either participating in carrying a Narcan kit or feels that they're probably addicted or maybe addicted. Where do people go to get direct help other than these meetings? Can they come to the health clinic or come to the PCHS or?
Yeah, I would say they could come anywhere they feel comfortable going in and talking to a provider about what they need. In regards to the Narcan, though, Kenai Public Health is open Monday through Friday, and anybody 18 or over can walk-in basis, ask for a Narcan kit, and you'll meet with your friendly neighborhood public health nurse, probably myself or others, and we'll sit down and go through the training and get you a kit or a couple kits if you need them. So.
And also PCHS and Soldotna, we're also a Project Hope distribution site, so you can also do the same and get a Narcan kit there. And I believe Change for the Kenai also is a Project Hope Narcan distributor as well. So if you can get a hold of them, they can also provide that. And then as far as folks who are looking for substance use help, really our mindset is there's no wrong door to walk in. Right. If you walk in somewhere, your medical provider, the ER, change for the keen eye. You contact Serenity House, you contact PCHS, you go to public health. The idea is that somebody there should be able to at least get you in touch with somebody that can more directly help with your specific issue, because addiction treatment isn't a cookie cutter, one size fits all thing. What works for one person may not work for somebody else. You know, I quit smoking a few years ago and I was able to do it with a step down method, but I know people that can do it cold turkey and white knuckle through kind of all those negative things, and more power to them, but I couldn't do that. And then there's folks that use medications like Zyban and Wellbutrin, and you know, there's the patches. There's a lot of different options for smokers, and we want to make sure that people understand that when it comes to addiction treatment, there's a lot of different options as well. And the idea is any door you walk in, you should be directed towards something that hopefully will help with your specific issue.
Yeah, I don't think if you ever ask for help, it should be a negative experience. And public health will link you to the right people. We'll get you where you need to go. So,
terrific. You know, I was just going to ask about you're talking about the people going down for the kits. Is there confidentiality worries from people who come in? Or they go, you know, like, oh, you know, I go in, you know, because my nephew Bobby, you know, he's a heroin addict, you know, but I don't want anyone to know. And, you know, they come in. Are there people, are people nervous about coming in, and should they not be?
I think that because we're a government agency, I think that there is some worry. But just like with any healthcare, I have a strict confidentiality policy and a privacy policy that I adhere to because I'm a professional. And so we tell people that it is absolutely confidential, and we actually have people come in and pick up for others because other people maybe don't feel comfortable to come in on their own. So,
yeah, and then there's very basic kind of demographic information that's gathered for the purpose of tracking, but your name is not one of them. As far as there is a question on whether you intend to use this for yourself or for somebody else, but there's no other follow-up. It's not, well, who are you intending to use this for? Or who are you concerned about? The idea is that we want to make it as accessible as possible for folks to get these Narcan kits because they can potentially save a life. And so for anyone that has any concerns around, oh, your information is going to be turned into the state or that it's going to be used somehow against you, that information really, I think it's as basic as your gender, your
date of birth.
And
it also has a contact number just in case for any reason that the Narcan medication itself might be faulty, that we would need to recall it, but it can be any type of contact information that they're willing to provide. And if they want to give them a name, they don't have to give a real name. It could be Donald Duck, and that would be fine.
Yeah.
We are pretty much out of time. I have one last quick question. Do they have a Narcan for alcohol?
No.
I know it sounds funny, but, you know, that would be an idea.
I don't believe that they've got a Narcan medication for alcohol. They have some alcohol treatments like anti-abuse and those type of things. But, right.
Yeah. But it's something that would take somebody from inebriated to sober as quickly as Narcan does. I don't believe that there's anything for that. No. Yeah.
Narcan starts working within 30 to 40 seconds. So
wow.
It's very quick and effective.
And it's as you said a couple of times, receptors on the brain that are being replaced, literally replaced. That's probably not the action that alcohol takes. So,
yeah.
Great. Well, hey, thank you both very much for coming in. I really appreciate it. This has been a great show. Talking with Shara Pritchard, a public health nurse with the State of Alaska Kenai Public Health Center, and Fred Koski, Addictions Program Coordinator with Peninsula Community Health Services of Alaska. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.